Welcome back to the Film Experience. It's a top 10 podcast. Woohoo!
Yay.
So my math says that none of us can speak for more than 3.5 minutes apiece on each of 10 movies. Is that
Does anyone have an orchestra prepared to play us off?
Oh my God, that'd be amazing.
Remember that time I tried to time us with the timer and how crazy it made you guys?
Yes.
Number 10.
My number 10 is In Jackson Heights, which I saw at the New York Film Festival this year. It is a Frederick Wiseman documentary, and all that that entails. He's previously done movies like at Berkeley and National Gallery, and the style is these very sort of lived-in experiential documentaries. They're pretty long. This one around 3 hours. And it's about the Queens neighborhood of Jackson Heights, which is sort of famously one of the most diverse in the country. And you see some of the politicians, and you see some of the just sort of people who live there, and the people on like the beautifying committee, and just sort of the actual like ecosystem of this neighborhood. And through it, you get this, you know, the story comes to emerge of, you know, how maintaining authenticity in a neighborhood in New York City is so challenging with, you know, sort of gentrification around every corner. And but it never feels fraught. It feels very light and delightful. And there are just so many little scenes in that movie that I think of when, and I just sort of just break out laughing. It's absolutely wonderful.
So my number 10 is The Martian. I think if you've listened to this podcast a long time, you know I have a real soft spot for Hollywood movies that just work, that kind of click along and really feel like they know what they're doing. And The Martian really felt like that to me from the very beginning. It's got a great star performance, which is something else I really like that blockbusters don't often let you have. Like, Matt Damon is really doing all of his best Matt Damon things. And I know this happened at a time when we were all kind of mad at him for being an idiot on Project Greenlight. But that didn't really affect the way I enjoyed this movie at all, because I think he's got so many great movie star qualities. And Ridley Scott had this kind of liveliness to him. Like, but it's remarkable to me that someone who has had that long a career, who has made such a weird combinations of terrible and interesting movies, can make something that feels this light. I think Drew Goddard's script really aids it in that. And it's got this great ensemble cast. Like, for all the talk of like ensembles for SAG, I really thought The Martian got overlooked. It stuck with me. I haven't seen it since at Toronto, but it's really held up for me.
I just watched it this week again.
Oh wow. Oh, good.
And
Okay.
it really holds up.
Great.
It's just really light on its feet, which is really rare for blockbusters. They're so intent on, oh, we have to make this big set piece for
Yeah.
you. And it just feels like so effortless, which is its best quality, I think.
Yeah.
My number 10 is A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence, from Roy Anderson. And I saw it a year and a couple months ago at Toronto, but it did come out this year. I don't really know what to say about it because it's my top 10 that I think I least understand. But I mean, I just find that there's so much to look at. And it's such a cinematic experience for me, even though it's so static. Like, the shots are always, and the camera never moves, and you just stare at these dioramas where all these things happen. And the longer you stare, the funnier and weirder and more upsetting sometimes the tableaus get. It's just a very singular film, and I recommend it. But it's the type of movie where you can't stop it. You just have to turn off all the lights and just stare at it.
Yeah, I
It's
have.
really hard to get people to do on DVD.
I don't want to start an argument, but I watched this on Netflix and, you know, various reasons paused it, and I couldn't finish it. I got too suffocated by the tone of it and just couldn't find the humor in it anymore, and I gave up, which is not, I'm not proud of, but
Maybe you need to sit on a branch and reflect on your existence,
I
Casey.
probably should. That's gonna be my punishment.
My number 10 is Heart of a Dog, which was Laurie Anderson's documentary that came out this year. But documentary is sort of a weird word for it. It's more of a personal essay film, I guess. And boy, does she love her dog and all the dogs she's ever had. There are these adorable tributes to all of them. But I can get a little bit squishy, you know, in the face of, you know, I don't know. Anytime a national disaster happens and they go, people are suffering, but you know what's really wrong is that the animals. I'm like, I know, okay. But in this case, she's so touching, but also just touching in the way she talks about her own life. And there are so many just takeaway moments of insight that she's picked up. There's this speech I still remember about how one of the most important things in life is to learn how to feel sad when it's appropriate without becoming or being sad. And maybe that sounds silly, but in the context of the movie, it's really moving. And the images are really crazy, and I don't even understand how she was manipulating them at times. But it's gorgeous.
Number 9. My movie is a very sort of obscure little movie that I'm not sure everybody has heard of called Mad Max Fury Road. I recently watched this for a second time on HBO, and I was sort of worried about whether it would be a letdown because, you know, you worry about how things transfer to a small screen, and something certainly as sort of big and flashy and sort of grandiose as Mad Max Fury Road. But it really, it's still just in its bones such a good movie and such a kinetic kind of creation. And the colors still pop on, you know, my dumb little TV. It's just wonderful. It's just so captivating, and you just get wrapped up in the spirit of it, which is so like perverse in a lot of ways. Just like how I can't imagine still that we got a Best Picture nominee where there are so many like gross boily pustules on bad guys. And
you are selling it.
I also have a tiny movie from a tiny little studio that's the same as Mad Max. It's Creed, which I guess is now not as ironic to say it's tiny because of all the Oscar snub flap, but it was very successful. And I am like basically Rocky illiterate. Like I am aware of the franchise and familiar with scenes from the original and, you know, what happens in a Rocky movie, but basically had no attachment to it. But in that moment in the movie where the Rocky theme comes up in the boxing scene at the end, I lost my mind. I got so excited. And I really got sucked into the, not just the like kineticism of the boxing scenes, and boxing movies usually do nothing for me because I just can't stand the violence, but I thought there was so much emotion that went into all of the fights and the relationship between Michael B. Jordan and Sylvester Stallone. I mean, I've loved Michael B. Jordan for years and years. And I think everyone has a movie that they see him in there and they're like, holy shit, I will watch anything this guy does. And hopefully for a lot of people, that's Creed. And yeah, like a good father-son story, I've always fall for. I think Ryan Coogler is such a talented like visual director, which is not something I necessarily thought after Fruitvale Station, which I liked and thought was very effective, but not that like impressive as a directorial calling card. But Creed, I thought, really did it. And I love that someone can take a studio movie and can take a sequel, spinoff, whatever, and make it so personal and feel so lived in. Like all the Tessa Thompson scenes didn't have to be as good as they were. There's so many moments of elevating this movie above what it had to be to make it in something really great. And that's why I still love it.
My number 9 is Mustang, which is the French Oscar nominee this year, even though it's Turkish. And this is a debut film about a group of sisters who their extended family gets freaked out about them getting reputations because they're a little like high strung as teenagers can be. And what was fascinating to me about it is how it's about their lives becoming more and more constricted. And yet their liveliness within that can't be contained. Like they're sort of like inner selves and all their spirit. And I just found it so moving and so funny and sobering too. And I was just really 100% with it from start to end.
Mustang is the one I watched last weekend and like would have put on this list had I had the wherewithal to put it together. And I think the moment when I lost my mind was when I realized it was Pride and Prejudice, that it's five sisters being married off, but in this totally different context that makes it have totally different meaning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so good.
I wanted to make Nathaniel personally happy, so I have a joint citation as number 9. It Follows and The Tribe, which are both movies about groups of teenagers in these really overdetermined situations. It Follows, as probably a lot of people listening know, is this whole creepy, sexually transmitted haunting scenario, and The Tribe is set entirely within this Ukrainian school for the deaf. And they're both about a protagonist realizing that they're stuck in this system where they both have to rely on people their own age and try to stay away from them. From that point forward, their dynamics kind of move in opposite directions is enough to say. But I was really impressed incredibly by the formal control and the evoking of mood in both of those movies. And either one could have seemed really just trapped by its own, I guess you could say, gimmick in terms of It Follows having this really convoluted plot conceit and the tribe being totally delivered in sign language with no subtitles and no translating for 2 hours and 11 minutes. But they're both just stunning to watch, and they really hold up.
My number 8 is Noah Baumbach's Mistress America, which I know is not everybody's favorite on here, but I shall soldier on. I loved Frances Ha so much, and then I saw While We're Young at last year's Toronto Film Festival, and I was so crestfallen by seemingly Noah Baumbach sort of taking a whole lot of kind of bitter backhanded swipes at the same generation of people who he had depicted so generously, I thought, in Frances Ha. So I was very happy to see that Mistress America was returned to that. It makes me, you know, think that Greta Gerwig's influence on him is an incredibly positive one. I think this movie is a lot more overtly comedic than Frances Ha is. It's a little sort of goofier. Greta Gerwig plays this young woman in New York who is so intent on trying to be sort of everything, every fabulous thing, that she ends up being none of those things, and yet, you know, admirable for how much she wants to do it. And Lola Kirk plays her stepsister who sort of idolizes her. If Noah Baumbach is going to continue to make movies about generational divides and that kind of thing, that he keeps Greta Gerwig with him to sort of remind him that, you know, not all young people are shit. So
I'm like the Katie to my pigeon. I'm that to Mistress America, because I just didn't get it. I love Frances Ha so much, but I just couldn't connect to Mistress America.
Don't worry, Joe. I love Mistress America. Oh, okay. I have another movie about a young woman. It's Diary of a Teenage Girl, which I caught late. I think it had been at Sundance last year, and I didn't see it until my screener came in. But it was so unique and lived in and thoughtful and just not like any version of a coming-of-age story I'd ever seen. And it's kind of worrisome because you have this girl who, you know, she's 16 years old in San Francisco in the 70s, and her mom has gone through a divorce, and her mom, who's played by Kristen Wiig, who I think is so amazing, is like, you know, was married in the 50s, and it's in the 70s now, and she's divorced, and she's kind of like figuring out how to live in this new counterculture world. And her daughter kind of picks up on a lot of that and starts sleeping with her mother's boyfriend, which is a terrible idea on all accounts, but also really fascinating to watch. And I thought Belle Powley, who plays the lead character, is so good, and I hope to see her in absolutely everything from now on. And just the, you know, the boldness of it and the specificity and the, you know, the way that it incorporated animation is really interesting. I think Mustang is actually a really interesting companion with it, of a, you know, kind of wild teenagerhood it really captivated me.
My number 8 is Inside Out.
Ah, I watched that again yesterday and also strongly considered putting it back on my list.
When I first saw it, I had all these like quibbles with like the sort of the construction of it, you know, like the five emotions, like why is disgust in there? You're like all of these.
Which is exactly what disgust would say.
But it's so delightfully inventive, and it has so many like tiny little wondrous elements all shoved into this really brainy concept for a movie. And yet the takeaway, I think, is really profound, actually, that your various selves all have to be united for you to function properly. Like you have to allow for a full range of feeling in your life. Mm-hmm. Is, I think, a really profound thought that you don't get in movies.
Now, there's a period after seeing it, when I saw it this summer, where I couldn't think about those balls with the, you know, blue and yellow swirls in them without like tearing up, because I thought that was such a profound thought. Watching it again yesterday, it's so well structured and so ingenious that I think I also got too caught up in the concept and kind of nitpicking at it first, but so I'm really glad I watched it again.
My number 8 is Creed, and woo! I'll just let Katie have said everything that I would have said about it, except that maybe my proudest moment in the movies all year was when I screamed, "Yes, baby!" at the same time that Felicia Rashad said, "That's what I'm talking about!" And just exact same moment together, which either means you would definitely or definitely not want to see a movie with me.
But. And were you also wearing a fantastic white robe and like padding around your house?
And I was not. Drinking. I looked like shit, but you know, but my spirit was there. And that whole movie in every single emotional category is just so evangelizing. I laughed so many times. I cried so many different times. It's so great.
Number 7 is Spotlight. I saw this one at the Toronto Film Festival, and already buzz had sort of accumulated around it for Best Picture. And I remember thinking after I saw it, just like, that's going to be tough for a movie that sort of low on sort of big clippable moments to do something like Best Picture, and maybe, you know, that will end up being the challenge. But it's stuck with me so fiercely since I saw it. I think it's so disciplined in a way that, like, is not going, they just kept refusing to take these sort of easy, grandstandy, showboaty ways out of this story. And they keep, it's, you know, it's a movie whose style is very much tied to the substance of what the characters in the movie are doing. It's very sort of, you know, shoe leather work and nose to the grindstone and unflashy. The work of these newspaper reporters to dig out the Catholic Church sex scandals in Boston in the late 90s and early aughts it's very dedicated to telling these stories on like a ground level. And the best parts of the movie, and I'm not by far the first person to say this, are the scenes where the reporters talk to the individual victims of this stuff, and it really allows the whole thing to come alive in this very respectful and yet still very, you know, compelling way, where all of a sudden each scene is built on the last one, where you're just like, oh my God, they really got to get these guys. It really gets to every little angle of how people within this scandal have operated, and it just tells it in this really kind of economical way, and I think it's great.
My number 7 is Mad Max Fury Road. Joe, we're so in sync on our blockbusters.
I know.
Yeah, I really do think it's a miracle that this movie is a Best Picture nominee. I think we need to appreciate that more, because like somehow it became accepted over the year that like, oh yeah, Mad Max will get nominated for an Oscar, which is such an insane thing to think about a movie like this. But it makes you glad that someone can be allowed to spend a ton of money on a movie. But something, you could not get something that looks like this for cheap. And George Miller had this idea for this really beautiful, like very straight line story. Like, he knows he has all this crazy stuff going on, so he tells the simplest story possible. And there's like, I think that's the most maybe iconic of the blockbusters that came out this year. Like, there's not like a big quotable line of dialogue, but I will remember this so much more vividly than Jurassic World or maybe even Star Wars. Mad Max will stick with you and hopefully will be something that people try to make more of, though I don't know how you try to replicate that movie's success without having George Miller by your side.
I don't know, Katie, every time I like stub my toe on a street curb or whatever, I yell "witness me," so I don't know what you're saying about quotability.
You spray yourself with chrome.
Yes, exactly.
You'll be welcomed in Valhalla's, Joe.
Anytime I want to really like just martyr myself about something, I'll just yell "witness me."
My number 7 is Brooklyn. I don't have a lot to say about all these things I've been talking about them all year, but I think it's just really resonant and beautifully told, and there's something really comforting about a story that is so guileless and like a romantic drama that doesn't have any of the normal cheap drama. It's just very straightforward, but it's just so moving, and the performances are really like attuned to each other, and it's message about starting over, and that home is, you know, it sounds so corny, but home is where the heart is. But it just really works. And movies that really work, as Katie was saying with The Martian, you just have to like really embrace them, because it's hard to make a movie, and it's hard to make a movie that well.
My number 7 is In Jackson Heights, which Joe already paid great tribute to. And I'll just echo what he said, that there are scenes in it. There's one scene where a guy has to hold forth for about 15 minutes in an almost unbroken shot to explain how gentrification actually does work. And it's such a great emblem of the movie because you do learn so much. But it's also clear that he's hogging the mic. And so yes. You have this in a room of like, you know, 22 people who all want to talk about it. So you have this like two-pronged response to the same thing happening. There's all kinds of just moments I'll never forget.
My number six movie of the year is Steve Jobs. I have a fraught enough relationship with Aaron Sorkin's work over the years that I feel like I can never quite predict how I'm going to like something, even given the sort of general reception to things. And I was reminded that when Sorkin really gets going on a topic and finds the actors to speak his dialogue and doesn't get in his own way in terms of his own sort of technophobia, that it really can sing. And Fassbender and Kate Winslet and Jeff Daniels and Seth Rogen, who was not my favorite of the cast members, but I thought he did a good job, and Michael Stuhlbarg. And it's this kind of, it's a portrait of a person and not necessarily the person, and I really appreciated that, where Sorkin didn't really get hung up too much on making sure that he got, you know, the man as he, you know, exactly was in real life, but he really tells this very structured, some would say overly structured, but I liked that about it. I don't mind that sort of theatricality of, here's how this window in his life was a mirror of this window in his life, mirrors a mirror of this window in his life, like in three parts at three product launches. Like, obviously that's not how, you know, a life is made and the life is structured. But I found it very just, I could listen to it as an album. You know what I mean? In that way where it's just, there's a rhythm to that dialogue and there's a way that you know, the movie sort of flows along that I found completely, absolutely captivating.
I'm trying to think of a segue to my number six, but I can't think of any. It's Grandma, which is this very tiny movie that I think, you know, it came out in the summer and had some people kind of talking about it. I think Lily Tomlin was a dark horse best actress contender for a little while there. but it's so, it's got such heart behind it, but in a really distinct way. Like, Lily Tomlin is playing this very kind of, you know, deliberately mean and bitter seeming woman who is, you know, she's this lesbian academic. She would fit right in on Transparent. I couldn't stop thinking about that while I was watching Transparent season two. And, her granddaughter needs an abortion, and she comes to her grandma for help. Her grandma doesn't really have the money to do it, so they kind of set off on this odyssey across Los Angeles. I think A.O. Scott put this in Tangerine next to each other on his top 10. They fit in very well with each other as these kind of like journeys across Los Angeles for various purposes. But there's all these characters show up over the course of the movie. Like, I think that Lily Tomlin and Julia Garner at the center of it are really wonderful, but Judy Greer got her one good role of the year as Lily Tomlin's most recent Laverne Cox shows up for a minute. Nat Wolff, who I love despite being in a lot of bad movies, shows up as kind of a thuggish boyfriend, which is such a funny, weird casting for him. And then Sam Elliott shows up and just slays it as Lily Tomlin's ex-husband, yes. Who she comes to and asks for money. I mean, between this and LCU in My Dreams, he had a real Silver Fox year. And that whole scene of this, they have one scene together, but I would watch an entire movie about Lily Tomlin and Sam Elliott kind of hating but still loving each other.
Well, that scene is like a whole movie.
Oh, it's, yeah. Perfect. It's so wonderful. It's like, yeah, there's just all these little gems throughout this movie. Like, Paul Weitz has always made these kinds of like thoughtful, affectionate movies that sometimes get, you know, appreciated and sometimes don't.
My number six is Phoenix. I know that the big Holocaust movie this year in terms of critics was Son of Saul, but for me, Phoenix was far more impactful. Because I just thought it was, the art of it was so amazing. It had all these elements of multiple genres, like noir and body horror and like all of these elements. And yet it was so the straightforward sort of like march toward understanding that, you know, the past is long lost to you. I just thought it was so haunting, and I have never stopped thinking about it since seeing it. I was just really blown away by it. The plot is so simple, but it's so mysterious at the same time. The ending is just out of this world.
So My Joint Citation's Diary of a Teenage Girl, which Katie already talked about so wonderfully, and I've paired it with The Wonders, which is an equally affecting but completely stylistically different coming-of-age story for a teenage girl. Since we haven't talked about that one, it's an Italian movie. It's set in this rural area of Italy among a family of beekeepers who are aware that they're not going to have a livelihood much longer. And so you're simultaneously watching them try to... It has a little bit of overlap with Mustang because there are a lot of daughters living pretty different lives in this family. And while you're watching this pretty bucolic realist drama, one of the daughters is also fascinated by this reality show with Monica Bellucci that's been filming just a little bit away from where they all live and is desperate to get on it. So you're kind of watching this contest between trying to preserve their authenticity and trying to move the whole family into the 21st century who's refusing to go. It's really touching, and I think it'll be out on DVD soon. And the opposite in every visual way from Diary of a Teenage Girl, but they both just completely emotionally overwhelm me.
This is the first I've heard of this movie. That's fascinating.
It was the runner-up at Cannes a couple of years ago, and I'd hoped it would get more of a push when it eventually came out, but hope maybe now.
So my number five is Room, and in the interest of brevity, I'll just say that it's... You know, fantastic lead performance by Brie Larson, yes. But I think it does go beyond that in the way that it depicts things inside the room and then later things outside the room, and the way that sort of that persistence of claustrophobia later and for certain characters that I thought was very sort of smart and well handled. And it packs a punch.
Joe, my number five is also Room.
Shut up!
Yeah, we can just use we can use this as an opportunity to save time.
Yeah,
it was great.
My number five is Ex Machina, which I'm obsessed with this idea of it being a play, which I know is not a new idea, but it's like basically three characters in one setting. I love when people do genre movies and understand that small budgets. Can like the constraints that you might have if you have a small budget can make really like wonderfully exciting decisions happen on a movie. And obviously they spent all the money on Ava. but you know, it's a science fiction film about artificial intelligence and the Turing test. Shout out to Imitation Game.
Yeah, man, Alan Turing's everywhere.
Respect the man, respect the test.
And I've seen it a couple times, and I like the actors are so in tune with the movie and the drama coming from how they're all like playing each other all the time. And I think it's weirdly sexy, even in moments where it maybe shouldn't be, like Oscar Isaac all the time. I just love it.
I think it'd be an amazing opera.
Ooh.
Just because it's all arias and duets, you know, and like they're so, each one has such a strong color to it, but the mixture of them is really complicated. I don't know. I just thought of that when you were talking about it being a play.
Yeah.
My number five is The Look of Silence. And I think that movie has more than made a case for itself that I don't need to say too much over the course of the year. But if I'd had any reservation about it, it was, you know, being paired with The Act of Killing, which forces your patience and empathy with a completely different kind of post-genocide narrative than you ever heard of. And being with characters who are really hard to be with. The Look of Silence has a little more obvious sympathy going for it because you're with victims. And it can be a little bit closer to what you might expect from a film of this sort, and yet it too just goes to places I had never been taken by a documentary before. And it is harrowing, and you should be ready for that, but there's something really moving and redemptive about it as well.
But Nick, it's obviously not as good as Amy. Come on.
We can't.
It is cruel.
You're just getting back at me for my ties.
It is cruel that those movies have to be paired together. Because I liked Amy, but yeah, Look of Silence is doing something so different and so important. And yeah, I love that movie too.
Number four.
My number four is Eden. This is Mia Hansen-Love's movie about the early days of the house music techno revolution, that sort of Daft Punk era of music. I mean, talk about like a character that I would not have expected to really get into, which is the sort of struggling techno DJ. But like, man, I really was so completely on board with everything that this movie was doing. It really evokes a sense of place and a sense of time, maybe better than anything else that it's on my list. And I recommended it to everybody.
My number four is Phoenix, which Nathaniel talked about earlier, and it's everything that he said it is. I love the noir elements. I love the mystery of it. The guy who plays her, I can't remember any of the actor's name, so the guy who plays the husband, who I think of as the German Kyle Chandler, who also had a pretty good year, is so interesting in his brutishness, and kind of really similar to what Kyle Chandler does in Carol, I think, and that he's kind of a bad guy, but there's also a lot of humanity in him. It's so elegant and beautiful. Yeah, I love Phoenix.
My number four is Tangerine. Merry Christmas Eve, bitch. And it's almost my favorite Christmas movie of the year. I thought when I saw it for sure, I'm like, this is the best Christmas movie in years, but then it
You hadn't without... seen Rooney in that hat yet.
I hadn't seen Rooney in the hat yet, no. But I just love Tangerine. I think it's so quotable and so funny, and the lead characters, Cindy and Alexandra, are just, you know, real characters in the best sense of the word. I wish this was a franchise and I could, you know, they could travel and I could go with them next year to another location.
I would love that franchise.
On foot with thumping music. Like, I don't care where we're going. I just want to hang out with them more.
Tangerine and the Donut of Fire. Tangerine and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Right? I mean, does it always have to be superpowers and men? No.
My number four is Iraqi Odyssey. I only laugh because it sounds like such a cliche of a movie I would put on a top 10 list, but it's Swiss in the same way that Mustang is French. It's an all Iraqi documentary, financed entirely from Switzerland, where a lot of the filmmaker's family lives in exile, but it's a 3-hour 3D documentary. Wow. About one family's movements all across the world as they are pushed out of Iraq, forced back to Iraq, trying to at least hang out in the Middle East and fix things. Other people attempted to run away from them. And it just complicates every single thing you would not only assume about documentary in 3D, but about storytelling and lives as lived in a part of the world that we tend to frame in just a couple narrow ways. And so you meet like 15 of the family members, and every single story is so compelling.
My number three is Son of Saul, which it's a Holocaust movie. So I was being told to brace for something harrowing and devastating, and it is. But I found myself so wrapped up in the filmmaking choices of it, where it's filmed in this intensely shallow focus, which just sort of makes you feel like you are like riding on this main character's shoulder the whole time. And you're sort of, it's this very kind of you are there feel to it. And because, and it fits so well with the story of the movie, because he's the main character played by Geza Rohrig is in the camps, and he's part of, and the word is now escaping me, but it's
Sonder Commandos.
Sonder Commando, thank you. Jews in the camps who were basically tasked with menial labor in order to basically survive. And so this labor is like disposing of dead bodies, and it's so like grim in that way. And because he's so singularly focused on finding this child, and you can't see beyond like literally the limits of this person. You can't see, you know, the periphery at all. So you're sort of in this man's tunnel visioned objective the whole time, and I found it just absolutely completely enveloping and fantastic.
My number three is Mistress America. I think I love that. I love that Connecticut far scene so much. Like, I think that was when the movie, like, I was really enjoying it for a long time. Like, I liked Frances Ha fine, but it didn't like captivate me the way it did a lot of people. But I thought there was just like, I think I had this kind of cringing familiarity with Lola Kirk's character, who wants to be a writer and, you know, is in college and thinks she knows everything and knows absolutely nothing. And then when it got to the Connecticut scene, it just becomes this farce. I was just so excited by the rhythm of it and how confident it was, and all these silly jokes and all the performances working in tandem with each other. It was just such a pleasure to watch, and so carefully crafted. Like, you really, you know, you could have a really shaggy version of this movie where it's just like two girls being friends in the city, but it's so precise instead.
My number three is Room.
Yeah.
Which we've already talked about. But yeah, I think the performances are stellar, and you know, I just love how it's like Room and the world. Room and world are two completely separate things that are also like one's a microcosm of the other. I think it's really moving and really smart. And can I just say the production design just gets no credit, but that Room is so incredible.
I agree.
My number three is the same as Joe's. It's Son of Saul. And I'll just say I was surprised. I know that it's kind of impossible to release a movie about the Holocaust that doesn't engender a debate about whether its aesthetic strategies are responsible or not.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little surprised that this one proved as divisive as it did. Like,
maybe yeah, seriously.
I think its tactics are really stunning, and I think it manages to capture all that sort of first-person limited point of view that Joe was talking about without feeling narcissistic or apolitical or any of those things. I think it's completely staggering. So I hope that even people who are reading positive or negative things about it at least go see it to argue about it.
My number two has already been talked about. It's The Look of Silence. I will say that, like, I get what you're saying, Nick, about how the act of killing puts you so much more in the shoes of the perpetrators, and it's, you know, so uncomfortable in that way. I think The Look of Silence, because its structure is so much in these sort of, like, conversational scenes, I think the scenes where he's talking to he does talk to victims, but he also still is talking to perpetrators, and those scenes are filmed so sort of like dead on, and there's no escaping. You have such concern for the protagonist because he's somebody who's very much vulnerable by asking these questions, and he's making himself vulnerable. And I think in a different way than the act of killing, it still sort of puts you in this space in Indonesia where, you know, the genociders won, and how dangerous that is to even just be talking about it.
My number two is Spotlight, which Joe talked about already. And as I think I mentioned before, like with The Martian, like really liking watching ensemble acting, and Spotlight is such fascinating ensemble acting. There's like, that's why the whole Oscar campaign for it was so complicated, just because it's really hard to pick someone out of the bunch, and watching everyone work in tandem with each other is such a pleasure of the movie, and is a pleasure of like working with a group of people that, you know, it's a familiar feeling from, even if you haven't worked on a newspaper before. And the way the movie has admiration for the work and for what it takes, and for, you know, is clear-eyed about the mistakes that happen at the Boston Globe before this happened. Like, they, you know, I think some people think that it doesn't hold them accountable enough for overlooking the story beforehand, but I think it's really smart about the way that it handles it and acknowledges that, like, the people who do this most important work are also people who want to get home at the end of the day. And even the smartest, best people can overlook something like this. It's really powerful. It's like a lot more visually interesting than I think it gets credit for. I'd be very happy to have it as a Best Picture winner.
My number two is Mad Max Fury Road, which is on everybody's list, it sounds like. I'm just, you know how they always talk about, you know, like film classes always look at the shower scene in Psycho for, you know, to describe what editing is, that sort of thing. I feel like Mad Max is the type of movie that they really should, I really hope that they start teaching in film school, because there's so much visual storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
The scene after the first break you get in the action, the first breath you can take where they go into the sandstorm and then the lights go out. The scene right after that where Max sort of discovers all the women. That entire sequence, I keep watching it. It has so many fascinating things to teach about point of view and editing or whatever. And that's just one sequence. I really feel like it's a masterclass. If George Miller does not win Best Director, I'm going to be really disappointed.
Mm. I'm lecturing on Mad Max this Friday in my class. And when I announced it as on the syllabus, I got 20 more students the next day.
Nice.
So what a perfect setup. It's not on my list, but it's so great. It's hilarious that by having Carol as my number two, I'm the first person to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
But and also going last in the order, I'm still the first person to talk about it. But what hasn't been said on the film experience about the many virtues of Carol? I imagine we're about to all sort of pipe in about them. I'll, if I have to single out one thing, I guess I'll just say the way in which it makes that transition from one character's primary orientation to the other's without seeming like it's executing a gimmick or an arc, and you just sort of realize that you've been subtly moved, and that you know both people equally well and equally unwell, even by the end. It's amazing.
Yeah, my number one movie of the year is Carol.
Carol is not my number one, so please address your angry emails to me directly. I look
forward
to hearing your hatred. I mean, I know when we talked about this, I think I kind of put, I don't know, I shouldn't have to talk about Carol, because this is all about things that we love. But Carol is a movie I admired that did not make my top 10. My number one is Son of Saul, which Nick and Joe have talked about. But I think one of the things that I really admire about it that you guys didn't mention is that, you know, the concept is sold to you as, like, this is a man in a concentration camp trying to bury his son, trying to find a rabbi. And you're like, okay, so this is a pretty emotionally wrenching thing. But it's a lot more complex than that. Like, the relationship between him and the boy and him and the rabbi he finds and the people who are helping him or not helping him are really complicated. And you get a sense of this world that exists within this camp where everything is so tenuous. The fact that they've kind of carved out society is really impressive. And I think that's hammered down even in the very ending of the movie, which I know some people weren't crazy about. So Son of Saul really kind of surprised me by becoming my number one.
Yeah, I did not know that
yeah.
Was a, yeah.
Well, the great thing about it is no one can really give you hard time because, like, oh yeah, Son of Saul, okay. It's not like having
except for none of you gave me a hard time when I said that I thought Phoenix was so much better than Son of Saul, and all of you had Son of Saul higher.
Yeah.
Oh, I caught it.
I quietly seethed.
we'll address our angry emails to you.
Yes.
Okay. My number one is Carol, and I'm going to be uncharacteristically tight-lipped about it just because I've written about it so much already and more is to come because the Filmage Awards have begun. So I will be writing little snippets about various elements of it, but I really haven't loved a movie this much in quite a long time. I'm truly madly deeply in love with it.
My number one is Arabian Nights, which I haven't loved another movie this much in forever. I mean, the fact that Carol or Son of Saul are not number one on my list is ridiculous. And there's this kind of story going around that you could watch them in any order or just watch part of them. And maybe that's true, but I none of the things I love about it would have made sense without watching them in sequence. And it's incredibly demanding, you know, sort of 6 hour, 20 minute thing that goes really up and down the scale about how much it wants to gratify its audience. But I'd never seen a filmmaker try most of the things that this movie's doing all the time. And it's such a self-conscious, because of the Arabian Nights conceit, kind of study of storytelling and all the different ways you can have an effect sensually or persuasively or politically on somebody who's listening to you. And, you know, this could be a course all by itself, but I'm as astounded now by it as I was while I was sitting in front of it months ago. I was going to wager before we started that there'd be no movie that was on all four of our lists, and that was true.
That is true.
What,
Carol was on three, Son of Saul was on three, Mad Max was on three?
I like this. I like this diversity we got. It's not,
yeah.
It's not just Nick who can throw in the curveballs of things that you wouldn't expect to be on lists.
All right, thanks for listening, and make sure to see all those movies.
Right now.